This is the Nick DeVos recording. All Nick DeVos recordings are in public domain. More information and find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The History of England from the accession of James II to Thomas science. gazing at the little moment. Perception, the sense of it, should never have reproaching that is greatest. But there is reason to believe that he was perfidious, not only from constitution and from habit, but also on principle. He seems to have learned from the theologians whom he most esteemed that between him and his subjects there could be nothing of the nature of mutual contract, that he could not, even if he would, divest himself of his despotic authority, and that in every promise which he made, there was an implied reservation that such a promise might be broken in case of necessity, and that at the necessity he was the sole judge. And now began the hazardous game on which were staked the destinies of the English people. It was placed on the side of the House of Commons with keenness, but with admirable dexterity, coolness, and perseverance. Great statesmen who looked far behind them and far before them right at the head of that assembly. They were resolved to place the king in such a situation that he must either conduct the administration in conformity with the wishes of his parliament, or make outrageous attacks on the most sacred principles of the constitution. They accordingly doled out supplies to him very sparingly. He found that he must govern either in harmony with the House of Commons or in defiance of all law. His choice was soon made. He dissolved his first parliament and levied taxes by his own authority. He convoked a second parliament and found it more intractable than the first. He again resorted to the expedient of dissolution, raised fresh taxes without any show of legal right, and threw the chiefs of the opposition into prison. At the same time, a new grievance, which the peculiar feelings and habits of the English nation made insupportably painful, and which seemed to all discerning men to be a fearful augury, excited general discontent and alarm. Companies of soldiers were billeted on the people, and martial law was, in some places, substituted for the ancient jurisprudence of the realm. The king called a third parliament, and soon perceived that the opposition was stronger and fiercer than ever. He now determined on a change of tactics. Instead of opposing an inflexible resistance to the demands of the commons, he, after much altercation and many evasions, agreed to a compromise which, if he had faithfully adhered to it, would have averted a long series of calamities. The parliament granted an ample supply. The king ratified in the most solemn manner the celebrated law, which is known by the name The Perdition of Right, and which is the second great charter of the liberties of England. By ratifying that law, he bound himself never again to raise money without the consent of the Houses, never again to imprison any person except in due course of law, and never again to subject his people to the jurisdiction of courts martial. The day on which the royal sanction was, after many delays, solemnly given to this great act, was the day of joy and hope. The commons were crowded, the bar of the House of Lords broke forth into loud acclamations as soon as the clerk had pronounced the ancient form of words by which our princes have, during many ages, signified the assent, the wishes, the estates, the realm. Those acclamations were really echoed by the voice of the capital and of the nation. But within 3 weeks, it became manifest that Charles had no intention of observing the compact into which he had entered. The supply given by the representatives of the nation was collected. The promise by which that supply had been obtained was broken. A violent contest followed. The parliament was dissolved with every mark of royal displeasure. Some of the most distinguished members were imprisoned, and one of them, Sir John Eliot, after years of suffering, died in confinement. Charles, however, could not venture to raise, by his own authority, taxes sufficient for carrying on war. He accordingly hastened to make peace with his neighbors, and thenceforth gave his whole mind to British politics. Now commenced a new era. Many English kings had occasionally committed unconstitutional acts, but none had ever systematically attempted to make himself a despot, and to reduce the parliament to a nullity. Such was the end which Charles distinctly proposed to himself. From March 1629 to April 1640, the Houses were not convoked. Never in our history had there been an interval of 11 years between Parliament and Parliament. Only once had there been an interval of even half that length. This fact alone is sufficient to reveal those who represent Charles as having merely trodden in the footsteps of the Plantagenets and Tudors. It is proved by the testimony of the king's most strenuous supporters that during this part of his reign, the provisions of the Petition of Right were violated by him, not occasionally, but constantly and consistently, that a large part of the revenue was raised without any legal authority, and that persons obnoxious to the government languished for years in prison without being ever called upon to plead before any tribunal. For these things, history must hold that making himself chief responsible. From the time of his third parliament, he was his own prime minister. Several persons, however, whose temper and talents were suited to his purposes, were at the head of different departments of the administration. Thomas Wentworth successively created Lord Wentworth, an Earl of Strafford, a man of great abilities, eloquence and courage, but of a cruel and imperious nature, was the crown for the most trusted in political and military affairs. He had been one of the most distinguished members of the opposition, and felt towards those whom he had deserted that peculiar malignity which has in all ages been characteristic of apostates. He perfectly understood the feelings, the resources, and the policy of the party to which he had later belonged, and had formed a vast and deeply meditated scheme, which very nearly confounded even the able tactics of the statesman by whom the House of Commons had been directed. To this scheme, in his confidential correspondence, he gave the expressive name of Thoreau. His object was to do in England all and more than all that Richelieu was doing in France, to make Charles a monarch as absolute as any in the continent, to put the estates and the personal liberty of the whole people at the disposal of the crown, to deprive the courts of law of all independent authority, even in ordinary questions of civil right between man and man, and to punish with merciless rigor all who murmured at the acts of the government, or who applied, even in the most decent and regular manner, to any tribunal for relief against those acts. This was his end, and he distinctly saw in what manner alone this end could be attained. There was in truth about all his notions a clearness, a coherence, a precision, which if he had not been pursuing an object pernicious to his country and to his kind, would have justly entitled him to high admiration. He saw that there was one instrument, and only one, by which his vast and daring projects could be carried into execution. That instrument was a standing army. To the forming of such an army, therefore, he directed all the energy of his strong mind. In Ireland, where he was viceroy, he actually succeeded in establishing a military despotism, not only over the aboriginal population, but also over the English colonies, and was able to boast that, in that island, the king was as absolute as any prince in the whole world could be. The ecclesiastical administration was, in the meantime, principally directed by William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury. members of the Anglican Church, Laud had departed farthest from the principles of the Reformation and had drawn nearest to Rome. His theology was more remote than even that of the Dutch Arminians from the theology of the Calvinists. His passion for ceremonies, his reverence for holidays, vigils and sacred places, his ill-concealed dislike of the marriage of ecclesiastics, the ardent and not altogether disinterested zeal with which he asserted the claims of the clergy to the reverence of the laity, would have made him an object of aversion to the Puritans, even if he had used only legal and gentle means for the attainment of his ends. But his understanding was narrow, and his commerce with the world had been small. He was by nature rash, irritable, quick to feel for his own dignity, slow to sympathize with the sufferings of others, and prone to the error common in superstitious men of mistaking his own peevish and malignant moods for emotions of pious zeal. Under his direction, every corner of the realm was subjected to constant and minute inspection. Every little congregation of separatists was tracked out and broken up. Even the devotions of private families could not escape the vigilance of his spies. Such fear did his rigor inspire to the deadly hatred of the church, which festered in innumerable bosoms, was generally disguised under an outward show of conformity. On the very eve of troubles fatal to himself and to his order, the bishops of several extensive dioceses were able to report to him that not a single dissenter was to be found within their jurisdiction. The tribunals afforded no protection to the subject against the civil and ecclesiastical tyranny at that period. The judges of the common law, holding their situations during the pressure of the king, were scandalously obsequious. Yet obsequious as they were, they were less ready and less efficient instruments of arbitrary power than a class of courts, the memory of which is still, after the lapse of more than two centuries, held in deep abhorrence by the nation. Foremost among these courts in power and infamy were the Star Chamber and the High Commission, the former a political, the latter a religious inquisition. Neither was a part of the old constitution of England. The Star Chamber had been remodeled and the High Commission created by the Tudors. The power which these boards had possessed before the accession of Charles had been extensive and formidable, but had been small indeed when compared with that which they now usurp. Guided chiefly by the violent spirit of the primate and free from the control of Parliament, they displayed a rapacity, a violence, a malignant energy the gunman was able, through the instrumentality, to find in prison Hillary and Multilay without restraint. A separate council which sat at York under the presidency of Wentworth was armed in defiance of law, by pure act of prerogative with almost boundless power over the northern counties. All these tribunals insulted and defied the authority of Westminster Hall, and daily committed excesses which the most distinguished royalists have warmly condemned. We are informed by Clarendon that there was hardly a man of note in the realm who had not personal experience of the harshness and greediness of the Star Chamber, that the High Commission had so conducted itself that it had scarce a friend left in the kingdom, and that the tyranny of the Council of York had made the Great Charter a dead letter on the north of the Trent. End of part 9. Read for LibriVox.org.